Welcome to the Write for Living podcast, where I talk to writers of all kinds. And today I'm talking to Alex, who is a comic book writer, and I'm sure other kinds. So hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to get right into asking about writing, and if you could share your backstory, and it's okay to go as far back as you want. How did you actually get into writing, and when did that start for you?
Yeah, sure. So, I was fortunate, you know, in my childhood, my mother, was adamant about, early education, you know, from like an early age. She, worked with me, at home, like working on the alphabet. And, you know, when I was really little, you know, reading books to me quite often, which is something I've carried over to my own children nowadays, and began to see the rewards from that. So that was, I would say, my love of writing started from reading, obviously, and just reading books of any kind. And when I got to school age, starting elementary school, I was reading chapter books quite early, and gravitated to science fiction and fantasy. And so at that point, it was my grandfather, my mom's father, who was a big into like Star Wars extended universe and old science fiction, you know, older science fiction, you know, our classic science fiction, I guess you should call it, like Dune, you know, Philip K. Dick, Ray Bradbury, things like that. So the books that I would eventually be assigned to read, like in middle school, I had already read when I was in elementary school. So that was always quite fascinating for me. And then I just think because of that, my imagination kind of grew from there. And I mean, all the time, I, maybe to my own detriment, to my parents' detriment, I was stuck in my head a lot. I was always like fantasizing about, you know, characters or just having stories. I kind of lived in my own world from time to time. And eventually, you know, that carried over to putting words on the page. And so from, you know, fourth or fifth grade, I think, you know, more writing assignments, and eventually started to scribble stuff down. You know, every time I would draw pictures, I would always flip it over and write like paragraphs on the back, like kind of explaining like what's going on. And yeah, I mean, from there, I had assignments at school, you know, and I may have thought about stories on my own, but I never really took the plunge to putting stuff on paper to show other people. I mean, until I was in my 30s, early 30s. I had, you know, recently just gotten out of a divorce, I was in the middle of, really, it is an extended period where I was in the middle of it. I was in the middle of like a kind of a messy divorce. I was on this mindset of like, hey, I don't want to live the rest of my life with like regret of like not being able to do something, you know, that is like important to me. And what I wanted to do was tell stories and see if all that stuff that I had written for myself privately on Google Drive was, you know, if someone else was interested in it. And so my first foray into really writing and bring it to a public audience was, my story, Digital Pools, which I started in 2019, with my partner in crime, Matt Stevens, who's the artist on that stuff. And yeah, it just kind of like sprouted from there. And I've begun to stretch my wings of more comic book stuff, you know, more comic book stories, as well as, I set a goal for this year to finish my first manuscript of a novel that I'm working on. Yeah, it's addicting, but it's a full-time job in the sense that I'm constantly thinking about it. You probably feel the same way, where I try to write every day. You know, but it's something that I'm glad I found now, because I wouldn't be able to, you know, it's hard for me to go through the day without thinking about writing or thinking about a story that I've got. And I'm just grateful that the technology allows me to kind of pick up my phone, write an idea down, carry that over to a, you know, a cloud document where I can continue those thoughts and just putter around in ideas. So I say, like, right now I'm really getting into it. It took me a while. but that is all built on the foundation of reading, reading many different things. And yeah, so now I'm here talking to you. So maybe I'm making some progress here.
Yeah, that actually, I think a lot of people will relate to that watch the podcast and or listen to the podcast. I know we have a lot of listeners now that are in, majority of them are in the United States and Canada. And I think a lot of them that I've spoken to, the actual listeners, are kind of the same. And I'll share like a little bit, like I really relate to that because right now I'm 32, but my life I feel like I've been through a heck of a thing. And I think sometimes you really need that in order to actually have something to write about, even if you're writing fiction. So yeah, it's relatable.
Just a thought on that. I totally agree with you. I think the hardships of anything, I mean, you know, true hardship, like, you know, losing a family member, you know, going through like a personal tragedy, or experiencing things, you know, if, you know, going overseas or seeing new cultures, like you're really experiencing the world, both its good and its bad. I totally agree. Can be incredible inspirations for writing. And I'll be honest, I think that's missing a little bit now. And some of the contemporary stuff that you can tell when, there's great storytellers out there. There's also some storytellers out there. I feel like maybe this, the victim of, a world where our world has become as connected as we are, it's become very small. We stay inside, you know, we watch the same content over and over again. We're attached to our phones. So I would encourage people to go out and experience the world, like get your heart broken, like be challenged. Cause those can have incredible moments of inspiration, you know, for a writing career, a hobby or a professional, whatever it may be. There are characters that I write that I know wouldn't be as real if I didn't have a pool of ideas to kind of draw from, you know. Many of my friends, my work, I'm involved in law enforcement and military and just government investigations. And so I never served in the military, but a lot of my friends did. And so if I wasn't able to travel with them and see some of the things that they've seen, work with some of the things that they've seen, you know, I wouldn't be able to write some of those characters as true as, you know, trying to get the essence of someone in that position, right? As opposed to just being an outside observer and all they hear is, or all they see about that kind of world is from other fiction, or, you know, one person removed, you know, from like a movie or television series. So I completely agree with you on that.
So I wanted to ask about you talked about writing every day, and I wanted to just, do you have like a word count that you're like, I want to get to a word count, or do you just write and put something down every day?
Yeah, I bounced around quite a bit, and I looked at just what other folks are doing, because like any writer, you're constantly comparing yourself to other people, and you're your own worst critic. You know, your own worst critic, I would say. I hate to set limits, or I hate to set expectations, because that's almost like an invite for a writer's block. You know, when you feel the pressure. Although I'd say the only limit or the only expectation is that I want to put words on a page. That's something. It doesn't have to be, you know, The Great Gatsby. I don't have to write, you know, chapters upon chapter or a specific word count. I just want to at least say that, okay, I did some time putting words on a page, or even like going back and reviewing something that I've written, you know, that I wrote, you know, a month ago, and going back with a fresh set of eyes, maybe just doing some proofreading, especially on, like, if you're working on a manuscript or something, that may be helpful, just giving it a fresh set of eyes on something and saying, oh, let the flow of that doesn't work quite well. You know, maybe I'll go and fine tune a couple things. I think as long as you're just involved in the craft, that's kind of my philosophy. Cause I am a procrastinator too. So I'll be honest, I am a procrastinator. So I constantly tell Matt, I'm like, hey, I'm going to get this done for you. It'll be done by Friday, and it's not done by Friday. Life happens, work happens, right? But also, I mean, just being blunt, like there's days I don't feel inspired. There's days I'm in a certain mode, you know, personal life. You know, I've got responsibilities with kids, and, you know, going to see basketball games or soccer games or track meets and things like that, and it just it just gets in the way. But as long as I can get on the computer and write a few sentences down, and I can go to bed thinking, okay, I did something. It may not be chapter upon chapter, but at least I took a step forward. As long as I don't take steps back or don't take any steps at all, which is the worst, I could say that I accomplished something. So no expectations, setting the bar low. That's the story of my life, and just trying to be pleasantly surprised with whatever I do. I think that's probably the goal. So don't try to restrict yourself. I guess that would be my advice.
I watched because I stream through the app and I put it on my television. I've read some of Digital Pools so far. And for everybody who hasn't, who's listening to this, could you explain a little bit about what is Digital Pools?
Yeah, sure. So Digital Pools is a story that's been in my head for quite some time until I took the leap to put it on paper. It's an idea that I had. I'm a child of late 90s science fiction, so computers were all the rage, and The Matrix was like my Star Wars moment, right? Basically, like any kind of cerebral science fiction thriller, I always had an interest in. And and that's carried over to be an inspiration for Digital Pools, but I always thought, like, what if technology takes us to a place where it is more optimistic, but the dangers of that technology are somewhat delayed, and they're not like as overt. And what I mean by that is, what if we're able to connect to a digital world where it's a mirror of reality, right? But it's a simulated world, but the dangers are really kind of like embedded within ourselves, like within our own psyche. And how we kind of project that onto other people. So the idea that I have for Digital Pools is that it's set in this world where, the mid 2030s, information is freely accessible to most people across the world through like a decentralized internet. There's nanomachines running through your body that help regulate metabolism and regulate health, clean energy, thanks to nuclear power, like nuclear fusion. As all these things are kind of converging, the classic, quantum computing, like all the developments kind of converge into one. There's these groups of people in the Northeast of the United States who develop the Exodus, which is this simulated reality. And how you connect to that is you submerge yourselves into these devices called digital pools, which are full of alkaline conductive fluid. And that conductive fluid connects to the nanomachines running within your body. And then, so as you're connected to the Exodus through this digital pool, you're, launched into this simulated world where you can feel everything. It's tangible. And you can create anything you want, be anybody who you want, or be anybody that you want to be yourself, right? But maybe be an alternate version of yourself. And you could experience whatever you want to as well. But with the good comes the bad. So there might be people there who want to subject you to horrors or some type of simulated, simulated pain or simulated torture, right? And so as this technology's growing, the government kind of hears about it, and they're like, okay, well, we hear reports about people being tortured for years when really they only have a submersion time of 5 minutes, right? So there's time dilation effects. Maybe there's some ways people have manipulated this thing to really subject people to unimaginable stuff. They formulate these groups called virtual crime task forces, which they fund these, basically send funding to police, big, large municipalities on the East Coast, where a lot of the industry is focused. And this story is set in Boston. I would say that the core story is set in Boston, where it's really the hub of all Exodus activity and all Exodus development. There's companies that are popping up trying to take advantage of this new world. And we follow a detective. He's a lieutenant detective called Julio La Rosa. He's kind of on the last few years of his career. Takes the job as, thinking this is going to be like kind of an easy babysitting job, you know, working with private contractors. One in particular, whose name is Rico Teller, who's a former co-founder of the Exodus. And together, you know, La Rosa begins to see, you know, all the possibilities within the Exodus, but on a lot of the danger. And they begin to stumble upon, you know, some nefarious activity, let's just put it that way, related to ghosts and you know, people from Rico's past, but also touching on, you know, more corrupt people who are in the real world that are trying to take advantage of the Exodus and what it could bring, you know, bring to people, but use it as a means to, you know, take control of people and take control of ideas, in the real world. So it's a kind of a slow burn, like cyber noir, that's the term we use to describe it. But it's a procedural, you know, crime drama, really, on a comic book format. And again, it's my first story, and I've been very lucky to you know, see the progress that we've made so far, and now getting partnered up with Macroverse, and you know, from the beginning, been partnered with Matt Stevens, who again is my artist on the project, and he's been an awesome creative partner to work with, and so we're on issue 6 right now. Going to finish the story, at least narratively, and all written down by end of the year. I know what the ending is. Just we have to, you know, finish up the comic book script and get that out the door. But yeah, it's been something that we're super excited about. But it's a living, breathing world. Like it's a real world with, like, you know, real as it can be in a fiction sense. But there's rules and, you know, there's nothing thrown away, I guess, when I've written there, and some of the things that we're bringing to Macroverse, you know, that'll become more evident as we release a few things, like a compendium that goes alongside the story and basically gives the power to people to, if you ever wanted to write your own story or have interest in doing that, you know, through Macroverse, you'll be able to kind of add to the digital pools world, as well.
Yeah, that was a, like, when I first read Digital Pools, or when I, like, heard about the idea of Digital Pools and then I started to read it, I was really excited about it because I was working at, before I went full-time freelance, I was working as a community manager for this educational startup that was using blockchain. And then right before I left, we started, we had this metaverse academy, so all of the students were kind of like in hanging out as like their own kind of characters that were them, but like in the metaverse world we had created. And as a community manager, I had to think about, like, well, we have to implement the same kind of things as maybe if we were on Discord, right, like for bullying and stuff, and we have to be able to, like, kick people out of coming back as their own avatar, which I was like, this is kind of trippy, man. But so I was like, okay, this is awesome, I'm really excited about this. And then I started to think, like, as I'm reading it, like, yeah, like, if something did happen to you, let's say for 5 minutes or whatever, but it was like, you know, somebody was like really fucked up, and like, that could stick with you mentally, you know. So
yeah, that's kind of the idea. I mean, it's this concept of mind crime that we introduce into the story, and it's more of like, yes, it's simulated physical pain, but, you know, I mean, not to get too you know, existential, but there's, you know, there's a lot, there's, you know, the simulation hypothesis, there's, you know, what is it, it begs question, like what is real and what is not real. Like, we perceive all those feelings and all those emotions anyway, as like this squishy, you know, what we believe, like, this squishy, you know, gray matter, like, inside this, you know, hard skull. And like, all we can see of the world is through our eyes and like our five senses, right? So, and if you're in a simulated world, you'd be feeling those same things too, but through a device, and it's interpreted by your brain. So it's just because if in this world, if you were subjected to some kind of like extended torture or something, then you woke up in the digital pool, like it's still like this visceral dream that you had, right? And you're right, like, it's, I mean, I have nightmares, or I'll have like terrors, you know, that are really intense, and I'll wake up and they stick with me. Like, I still remember nightmares that I had as a kid that stick with me, you know. I mean, I think there's parts of us, many of us have those memories, and yeah, something like the Exodus where that could happen to you, and to a much higher degree. Yeah, that's something serious, and who knows, like maybe that's something we'll have to deal with in the future.
Yeah, I showed digital pools to my friend, and he said that he thought he read that there was already some, like, police getting ready for the metaverse or something. And I was like, really? So, I mean, it is a thing, but I was like, what?
Yeah.
So I was like,
yeah. Digital pools. Who knows what form that may take? Yeah, hopefully I'm not too prophetic. Who knows? But I'm excited to see where the technology will take us. So.
And then kind of like back, you had talked about it a little bit. So when you're writing and for when people go back and read these characters, like what is the process for you for like developing characters? Do you have like the whole person in your mind? Do you create like all the elements of them, or does it kind of just like flow? Or like you said, you might have to do some research. Like, what is the process for that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So I don't have like a template, and I don't mean like template by character. I mean like I'm not trying to tell a story based on some kind of rubric. I really try to have it as like this flow state where it'll come to me, and I feel like I have a good enough sense, at least for my own stuff, to say, okay, this is crap. This is not a good idea. We should not. This is a half baked idea. Let's not pitch this right. But most of the time that there's ideas that are good. And if I have this idea, the characters kind of come naturally. I try to just take some, if I'm trying to think of a new idea, I just let those characters talk. In my head, right? To carry on conversations like naturally. I really try not to have anything too contrived, right? As in like pushing the characters towards some objective. But maybe in my head, I'll plant them in a circumstance. I'm like, okay, how would this person act? Like, I kind of know their backstory, and then I'll let them talk. And so once they become a little bit more tangible in my head, then I'll go back and do some research. There's one character in particular who's a foil to one of the main protagonists, Rico Teller. The foil that I'm speaking about is, his name is Deckard Moss. And he's this enigmatic kind of assassin type. He worked in the U.S. military as like very much a redacted career. So a lot of what he did is hidden from the public. But his backstory is mysterious. But it's known to me, right? But it could be mysterious to many other people, and that's okay. A lot of times you don't need to reveal everything about the character. But in learning like how he speaks or how he may interact with certain people, because he's always focused on protecting himself. Right. I do a little bit of research. I talk to some people I know who may be familiar with those types of people in real life. And I mean, okay, how would they go about setting, protecting their own identity or like, how would they act in like certain situations? So I'll take some notes down and try to apply that as realistically as I can without losing any kind of entertainment value. I still want to make the story interesting, right? So I'll add some flair there. But yeah, really the story ideas come, and then the characters kind of evolve naturally in my head. And then I just go from there. But if I feel like something's missing, like I feel like, okay, as much as I don't like contrived stories where it's just the plot says we need to do X, and so then we're going to do X, which leads us to Y. I really try to avoid that at all costs. But if there's a point where I'm like, this character could use, could use some support, maybe from like a supporting character, at that point, then I'm like, okay, well, what would that be like? One in particular, like Julio La Rosa, who's the lead detective on the Boston BCTF team. I wanted him to have an opportunity to kind of mentor like a young a younger officer leading that officer up into taking like the detective's exam, right? To kind of because he's Julio Rosa is a single man, never been married, no children. But I would, because you're almost always working with people in investigative capacity, especially in law enforcement. So I wanted him to have that opportunity as like a small group to kind of be mentoring someone. So that's where I came up with the character of Robert Mandel. And then it just goes from there. I'm like, oh, well, what's Robert's backstory? Okay. Well, he's Boston native, you know, he has a fiance who's like expecting a child, you know, it just kind of like evolves naturally. I'm like, okay, that works. Like that makes sense. And like, what does she do? Okay. Well, she owns her own restaurant, or it's a family restaurant. You know, she's inherited from her grandmother, you know, so it kind of just goes from there. And I just let those ideas kind of percolate. And again, like they're not all good. Like I'm not saying I'm like the master of ideas here. There are some things where I'm like, I think about it like the next day, I'm like, that's not any good. Let's cut that out. But really I just let the characters speak. That's really important. I let the characters kind of decide what's what, you know, in a way, how they interact in certain situations. And really, ultimately, like they end up driving the plot. I really try not to say this needs to happen, so this character needs to say, you know, ABC. I really try to avoid that. I try to let the characters speak as naturally as possible, and organically, I guess.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Ashley. That's something that I was talking with Jordan about, and he said that basically, you know, Frank at Home on the Farm.
No.
He wrote a comic about a World War I veteran that's like isolated. He comes back home from the farm to his farm, and he's expecting to see his family there, but there's a bunch of animals, and then it gets really like horror like, but really it's like because he's traumatized. So yeah, it was more like, what do you do in that situation when you're kind of, your characters are like animals, and like the main character was the one that's kind of driving the plot.
Yeah.
And that kind of took me down this like, research driven thing where I'm like, okay, like, can I find other examples of this? And like the best example that I could find from film, I think, where it's like more dialogue, but the characters like driving where this is going, is There Will Be Blood, if you've seen that movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I distinctly remember seeing that movie in theaters. Yeah. It was really good.
And, I don't know. So, where I was going with that was basically like, I agree with you. And, it's just been really interesting to like, see how ask the questions of like, how do people actually develop these characters? Because I don't know. It's kind of weird to me too. Like, I have no explanation for it, of like how we have these things in our minds and they're like talking and they're the ones actually driving it, but we're writing it down. And it sounds creepy, and I'm not to sound like whatever, like, yeah, that is like our minds, but it is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I guess in another state, you'd be considered crazy. Like you're listening to the voices in your head, but you're kind of creating this world. But just, again, on that, like in the manuscript that I'm working on, it's a science fiction. It's a novel, that I'm working on. But it takes place in like another galaxy where there's no humans there. There's distinct races that are working collectively, like in this group of star systems. And so I definitely have to let those characters kind of speak, even though I know like what, you know, how each race is like what their culture is like. It's challenging because I have to kind of remove myself as a human being, because a lot of their inner dialogue, you know, the words that we take for granted, right? Like calling dirt earth, right? Or saying, you know, hand or feet, or, you know, or using anthropomorphic language. So like language that only like humans could really use, I guess, like, because we see the world around us and we call things as they are. Right. You know, they may not they probably wouldn't use that language, you know, like in another galaxy. Like, and I mean, I keep it so that people can obviously understand. I'm not making up words, or I'm not going into so far into like creating a whole new language. But I'm trying to keep that in the back of my head as, you know, as if one of the main characters gets introduced to another character, they're not going to state, you know, this man is, or this man is, you know, X a number of units tall or something like that. You know, they would describe that character in terms that are probably a little bit more, you know, general, right? Instead of anthropomorphic language. And so I have to kind of let the character speak in that tone. But in the back of my mind, I kind of have to go back in and edit some words as I come on the page. And, anyway, I maybe that wasn't the best parallel tangent to that, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm constantly thinking, I'm constantly listening to those character voices. And again, I underscore what you're saying is that the character driven stories, character driven narratives are super important. And it just goes back to like classical style of storytelling with like the character arc, you know, the hero's journey, which is a little lost now, I think. I think we're for some reason, you know, we went through this period where we were almost against trials and tribulations of a main character and seeing them struggle and seeing them hurt and eventually overcoming that. Like that's something much more relatable to everyday people, I think, than just having someone who has everything given to them. And seeing them succeed and succeed and succeed, that's just, you know, unrealistic. And again, it goes back to being kind of contrived as to like whoever's creating that character is like pushing that unrealistic situation onto them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Have you heard how Alan Moore said that he created a few characters? Like,
I may not be familiar with the specific reference you're using, but I am familiar with how Alan Moore at least perceives his own writing, you know, as being like spiritual, right? And like he's like he's a real magician, right? And right.
I read that he like basically he had this character that he wanted to get it really understand, but it wasn't like from Earth, and so he shut the curtains and everything so that his neighbors wouldn't see, and he like crouched down and like started like acting really weird like the character, and like I don't know why that made me laugh so hard because I was like picturing him like crouching around like hunting around his room like making all these weird faces and stuff, and I was like.
Yeah, I know, and I would just assume he does that anyway because he's Alan Moore. But yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, there's like, you know, I may not physically do that, but we may find ways to kind of set ourselves in that mindset. Maybe if I'm ever close to, if I ever gain any kind of success that's it within his orbit. You know, far orbit. Maybe I'll result to to those methods without feeling too ridiculous, right?
Yeah, that's I don't do that, but I thought that was so funny. I might do it. What I have another question here about like how we talked about your partner Matt and the your like team member. So when did you meet him and like how did that happen? Like did you like his art or did you have you known him for a long time?
Yeah, so the story of meeting Matt, basically I had the idea of Digital Pools. I had about probably the very first draft of the episode, I called it, of Digital Pools. 'Cause at first it was going to be like a TV series, but then I was like, well, it's a little easier to do this as a comic book, right? 'Cause just based on the art, the art fee, like having the artist draw it, like that's much more reasonable than having a technology budget to really make this come alive. And so I was like, okay, well, I got to find an artist to make this come about. And so I looked, I could have gone, you know, on the web and looked for really any artist in the world, which is an amazing thing. You know, I've worked with artists all across the world, which is awesome. You're able to connect with people, you know, in various countries to help bring your ideas to life. But I really wanted to work with someone who was local in Connecticut, where I live. And so I just looked on Google as like Connecticut comic book artists, and I think Matt's page was one of the first ones I looked at. And everyone says it's about Matt's art, but it's everyone says this is because it's true. Like his colors are like the first thing that you really notice, and his overall, like his art is outstanding. Like really go from line art to inks to color. But his color, he is just a master at that. And he knows it more than anyone. But that was what really drew me at first. His color palette was just incredible. And thinking about the story and as it evolved, as the ideas of the story evolved, and how crazy we could get into like the simulated world of the Exodus, I'm thinking like, okay, we could really lean into this. And so I reached out to him. I'm like, hey, you don't know me, but I saw your art page. Looks really cool. I've got this idea for a story. And so we set up a call one day, and I was like super nervous. The woman I was dating at the time, who's now my fiance, she was really pushing me. She's like, you should just go for this. Like do it, leave everything out, out there. Just go for it. So I called him, and I was like, okay, here's the pitch. Like I was super nervous to tell him, so I kind of explained the backstory, kind of explained where the story's going. I got a little excited at parts, and I know I was rambling. But he was like, no, that sounds awesome. He was like, these are some things that I'm thinking about all the time. And yeah, it was like right there at that hour-long call when I was like laid on my couch, just like telling him, fanboying on my own stuff, or like really getting immersed in him. Like, I think this could be really cool. Like, so what do you think? Like, maybe we could work on something together, do an 8-page teaser and try to pitch it. And so that's what we did. We for like the next few months we honed the script, we honed on the script, changed a lot of the structure, and kind of did like a teaser of like what we were thinking. And then we just started distributing that out, doing the independent comic book route, like going to Scout, going to Dark Horse, going to Top Cow Image. And we heard back from all of them. A lot of those people, they get tons of submissions, that they said, now, not now, but later. Like they always kept the door open. We got really close with a couple of those publishers. But as we're going through this process, Kickstarter was coming around too as like a platform for a lot of folks to kind of get their stories off the ground. And we're like, well, let's give this a shot. And so we did. The first campaign was successful. We were able to fund the first book, and then that's how we kind of funded the first 5 issues, was through Kickstarter. And that was over the course of a couple of years. But yeah, it'll be coming up on 5 years. We started in May 2019. So Matt and I will have our five year anniversary as creative partners, in just a few months.
Yeah, the when so I'm gonna link everything down below for the podcast, so for people that are listening, if you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening on podcast platform, it'll be in the description. But when you go and even just start digital pools, like in Xero, because if you have the app, you can pay for the app. Not that expensive at all. So you'll have access to like what's there now. And just from like Xero, when you go in and you see the art and you start reading the story, it is really, really cool, especially when you're tapping it. Like, because the, like you said, like the color that he's done, especially for like different moments. Like one that is like jumping out at me from like the very, very beginning, it's like when there's a character that's not doing well. I don't know how to say it. I don't really like do it for people. Anyway, just go and read it and then see the color and see the artwork for those, because it is really awesome. And like I don't really know how it's done, but like as it's transitioning to different scenes, like the color changes with that kind of change, but there's a little bit of color left from the previous scene, which it like allows you to like not break it in your mind. So you're not like, so you're in the story still, so you're not like, oh, I'm reading, you know, you're not brought back to earth, kind of. If that makes sense. I don't know, but I wanted to say that so that people actually go and like experience this.
Yeah, no, he's got a good method. He has like a limited palette, but not limited in terms of like the colors are muted. He usually chooses like three or four, colors to work with, per section of the book. So, our comic books are, generally speaking, they're about 32 pages long each, no ads, so it's like full color. So there's a lot of content there. So each chunk of each scene within each book is usually has its own color theme, right? But yeah, it's very distinctive. It's very, very distinctive. Keeps you engaged in the story. Yeah, and some of those pages you open up, just, they're like colors like shining on your face. They really suck you in.
So what do you think about like the future of comics in terms of like digital comics or print comics? Because like I still really love print, and I experience digital. Like now I'll stream with the app on my television, so it's kind of like I'm reading, watching. But I still really love print at the same time. And do you think like there in the future, right, there's like it's gonna be even bigger where you're like experiencing all these things, but we still kind of have print because every person I talk to still loves print. What do you think about that? Or even just like some thoughts on like you've mentioned a few times, like how I'll ask that question, then I'll ask a different question, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no, trust me. I can I think that print of anything will always be around. I certainly think that there's this hesitation among, let's just put the comic book community, let's just talk about this community right now. There's a flux that is they're driven by many different things. One is that we're coming off this, comic books have kind of transcended their own genre and become this pop culture phenomenon over the last 15 years, for better or for worse. I think in a pop culture sense, I think it's becoming, just my honest opinion, I think it's becoming oversaturated. Comic books have always been a pool of ideas at which people have drawn, other forms of media from, like movies. A lot of the movies, science fiction, are inspired by, comic books. They may not be superhero comic books, right? But they could be just comic book stories, traditional independent stories. So I think there's a lot of change within just the comic book industry as a whole. And I think readers in general, like, all if you just look at the wide spectrum of readers, like, readers are hungry for something. I don't think they know quite what it is yet, but the Marvels and DCs of the world, or I guess the Marvel and DC, because those are really like the big two, right? They're struggling too. I think they've lost sense of what formula really works. And I think as soon there's a shift occurring where, we're going back, instead of using the comics as like a reflection of like what is being told in pop culture and like movies, for instance. I think, there's going that change is probably going to go back and say, okay, what makes this medium great? Like, why is the comic book work for a certain style of storytelling? And so I think people, one, are hungry for whatever that shift back, whatever that, like, that missing formula that's gone, they're gone, and they want it to come back, and they want to get excited again about the stories that they're reading, within, on like every new comic book day, and like the weekly and like the bi-weekly and the monthly releases. But at the same time, they're afraid of losing that paper version, that sense of community as it moves to digital, because of this idea that, I can't physically hold this, or I don't have a sense of like physical ownership. I think that, blockchain itself, if you cut through the noise and look at it, the companies that are taking advantage of blockchain as like as a means to bring digital ownership and make that bring digital ownership to the forefront and make it realistic for people, I really think they're going to succeed. I really, really believe in that. Macroverse, obviously with their concept of digital ownership through blockchain technology, I really think that in the near future something will click, maybe with folks like yourself and I, who're kind of bridging that, bridging that generational divide between old paper and like everything digital, right? You know, we probably see that more than most. But I don't think paper is going away. I just think digital is going to offer more unique experiences that just frankly paper can't. It's going to bring us into ways to access on our phone stories, like through Tap Stories, or ways to view a similar type of a comic book narrative that we could see as we open up and look at the entire page in its entirety. But it's going to give us access to strong opportunities for stronger communities, or stronger immersion, like in these worlds, because we're already connected to our devices. And once we kind of bring more of that content from paper over to digital, I think it not only gives new experiences that are only available in digital, but it could also help amplify and pair up, you know, to traditional forms of comic books, you know, with this term of, like, you know, fidgetal, right? Having digital access and digital ownership that's married to some kind of physical asset in the real world. So, you know, it may not be a very clear answer as you wanted, but I don't think physical is going to go away. I don't think it's going to be like this niche thing either, right? That 30 years from now, whatever the 30 year version of hipsters and you know, like hipsters basically resurrected records, right? Yeah. I don't know if they'll resurrect old comic books again. I really don't think they're going to go away. I really don't. I just think digital is just going to offer something else, you know, that'll be enticing to folks who are interested in these types of stories.
Yeah, like when you say that, I was talking to my partner, and I was like, okay, I really think that this is the future. But well, because I got into blockchain and researching, like, why some of this came about, like, with cypherpunks, and they put out code and pretty good privacy as a software. And then the NSA didn't want that out there for security reasons and a bunch of stuff. So I was really, a while ago, really got into, like, what the hell is all this and why did this happen? Basically from my job and everything, I was like, this is the future. I really feel this. And then I was talking to him and I said, I've met so many people, though. Like, I really, in the comic space, I met so many people that are, like, really against this, though, you know? And he said, well, why do you care? If you really believe this is the future, why do you care that they don't, you know? And I was like, I don't know then. But there is still a divide, but I think maybe sooner than we think, people are going to come around and realize that this actually is, like, something, you know, and it's not going away. Like, there's no way that it's going away. So I don't know why fight it so much.
I believe it too. I totally understand that too. I kind of have myself, I look at myself thinking, like, why do you care about, you know, because we Matt and I've gone to conventions and we have our paper books there too, but then we're also trying to sell, like, hey, here's the digital platform. People are looking at us like, why are you talking about that at a comic book convention? And you know, just be open to it. I think the tribalism, you know, there's too much tribalism out there anyway. People just want to get mad at certain groups because they don't agree with everything that they agree, you know, they have so many beliefs, and if you disagree with one thing, you're an enemy, right? I think maybe the same thing for, like, the old guard on the comic books, like, oh, you're into digital. Well, that's not real comic books. Well, maybe they can coexist, right? And quite possibly, maybe they could save the comic book industry, because the comic book industry is in flux. It's also in, like, a dire state. I like, a lot of comic book stores are struggling, and that missing formula is going to come. I think I really believe they're going to be saved, but it's going to have to work with this new digital format. And I think that digital format, whatever the end result will be, and I think Macroverse and others are going to be at the forefront of that. You know, there's elements of what they're bringing to the table that could help relieve them, right?
And okay, I just have a few more questions. I want to make sure I ask for the actual audience that's listening. okay, do you have any advice for other like listeners that are wanting to get into comics and they might be hesitant, and you just talked about this a little bit, but any general advice for them now that you're in this position?
Yeah, I'd say that it can be, so I'll be honest with you, I'm not a I am a comic book reader. I'm a graphic novel reader, but I am not a. I don't have rows and rows of white boxes in my attic. I mean, one, we don't have the space for that. Two, I'm not like a super comic book collector. I gravitate more to the independent stories, just because. I mean, listen, if DC called me right after I got off this call with you and was like, "Hey, we want you to do Batman Beyond," I would be totally on board for that. That would be like my dream gig, working on Batman Beyond, or really just any Batman series, because Batman is number one to me. But I'm really picky about what I read. I really am. I'm really picky about what I read and like what I grab off the shelf. I would say that anyone who's trying to like look into getting into comic books, it can be very daunting, because there's so much canon out there, especially on the big two. There's like, where do I even begin? Because there's been so many reboots of story arcs. There's been so many retcons of like certain things, certainly in like, you know, more contemporary times, a lot of weird changes to some characters. But I would say, like, you know, read what appeals to you. Like, comics is a visual medium, and if something stands out on the cover art and it really grabs you, like, take a chance and like read through it. The same goes for maybe not what's on like the new comic book day stands, but like what are in the white boxes at like your local store. If that, you know, if going to a store is intimidating, I know it's intimidating for most people, because they're like, oh, I don't want. You know, some store owners can be a little cranky or a little like, interesting people. But for the most part, like, they're all comic book lovers, and a lot of them are just like welcoming to anyone that wants to join the community. Right. But if it's still intimidating to go to a comic book store, go to your local Barnes and Noble, and there's a graphic novel section. And if there's a trade paperback that really stands out to you, like, grab it, like read it. And those are great ways to get in. It's like a whole run of like a certain storyline. Like, I've picked up, and I probably shop at traditional comic book stores more than most people, right? But again, those larger bookstores have great sections in there where it's easy to pick up something, and you know, you could pick up, you know, a Hellboy, you know, run. You could pick up, you know, a more recent, you know, like, I would say. Right, one of the best graphic novels I picked up, like at Barnes and Noble, was, I was really young, I picked up the Batman, The Long Halloween, which is a great story arc. Is actually inspiration for a lot of the Christopher Nolan movies that he did at Warner Brothers. I would say that's a great way to start if you're still intimidated by like that environment of like a new like a comic book store, and just being overwhelmed by what to select. Walk into your local store, like Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. I think Books A Million is still around. I hope Books A Million is still around. Or even if you're in the airport and you're trying to find something new, I always stop at an airport bookstore whenever I'm traveling. Frequently, I'll just run in there, and they usually have graphic novels there. I would say that's a great place to start.
I really love this conversation. I think that the people that listen to this are going to get a lot out of this, in terms of like, I know that people are interested in comics and in writing comics and really hearing how that works. And I know from my own experience of reading Digital Pools that it is a really cool story. And I know, like, if you're listening to the podcast today, I'll put the links, but really go check it out. But thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Yeah, Carly, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I think this was a great conversation as well. In fact, I'd love to kind of share a link with your audience too. We have like a free 3-month subscription to Macroverse Link that we could strategically use. I mean, I just want more people to read the story and get into it, so I kind of share it a little bit more liberally than maybe most people do. But I'd love to give it to you so you could link it to you know, the podcast and the YouTube, your YouTube channel, so that people could have just a free opportunity to kind of view the story in its entirety, as well as other stories that are on the Macroverse platform too. So yeah, I'll definitely share that with you. But thank you so much for having me. This was a great time. So thank you.